Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. We're in the same place for a change.
Back in the studio together.
Back in PDX. I'm glad to be home, by the way.
Good. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's a little toasty.
Yes, it is. But to the west of us, it's even hotter. So,
Yes, it is.
You can say that's worse or better, depending on your frame of reference.
Worse or better?
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about RAM for a couple minutes?
Sure.
Well, I want to send congratulations out to Team Hope for their second year of successful ramming. They came into Annapolis in 8 days, 29 minutes at an average speed of 15.55 miles per hour. They were about as steady as anything I've ever seen.
Yep.
They were great. Yep. Did you realize that on Team Hope, one of the riders was 22 and another one was in his 70s? I didn't realize there was such a disparity.
Wow.
That's funny. And then there was the Alta Cocker team, you know, the old farts team. And you know that
you're
somebody,
talking about,
Ronnie Bell.
Yeah, the Grand Pack Masters.
The Grand Pack Masters' average age was 79.
Yeah.
Not one of them was 79. Two were 80 and two were 78.
Wow.
Ronnie Bell, who is Dr. Ronnie Bell from Cleveland, the dentist,
mm-hmm.
was one of those riders. Nothing short of amazing as far as I'm concerned.
Those guys were steady, too. They had a very consistent pace.
They've only done it a million times.
Yeah.
I think they know how to do RAM. So the story of RAM really for us in Northeast Ohio is Cassie Schumacher.
Yes, it is.
As you remember, Cassie made her first solo attempt at RAM this year. She's only one of four women to do so. And at around 1,800 miles after a really rough start, she decided to abandon the race. So we all know she's crestfallen and angry, and she feels that she's let people down. But Greg and I do not agree with that. Her efforts were heroic, and we both think she did a great job. And I know Greg didn't expect this, but here's what he said on, it was Dennis Nowacki's blog?
Yes.
Yes. Paying tribute to Cassie's RAM efforts. And this is Greg speaking. On a very small scale, I understand Cassie's anger right now. As cyclists, each time we embark on a ride, no matter how long or short, casual or challenging, our number one goal is to finish under our own power. Calling for the sag or climbing into the team car is not how we want any ride to end. And although we know in the moment we had no more to give, as soon as the physical pain subsides and we thaw out, cool down, or uncramp, we immediately wonder what might have been if we'd only kept riding another mile, another hour. Soon enough, we stop dwelling on the past, start focusing on how we'll train harder and ride smarter tomorrow, next week, next month, and next year. Regardless of whether or not there is another RAM in Cassie's future, I know she'll never stop her efforts to honor all fallen heroes and support our wounded warriors, whatever form that might take. So from both of us, our hats are off to Cassie and all the other RAM riders of 2012.
Cassie posted a ride report on wheelsforchange.org this week.
Yes.
Very interesting reading.
It was scary reading. I was terrified reading that report.
I hope that one of the crew folks will post the, not the rebuttal necessarily, but just an alternate perspective on that. Because I have a feeling that in those moments, in those sleep-deprived, hot, cold, dark moments, there are many perspectives to what went on Race Across America. And I think it would be interesting reading to hear some of the crew folks. We'll see if we get that or not.
Well, her crew chief, Kat Espino, was on her way back, and she was posting along the way, driving back. She is one of the funniest people I've met her. She was in Cleveland last year, and she's just posting the funniest stuff. Last I saw, she was, well, she's probably home by now, but she was on her way to saying some really weird things about Las Vegas, which, of course, are easy to do.
Maybe you should get her on the show. Think she'd come on the show?
Kat? Probably.
Yeah, why don't you try that?
And she's got crews going for the next 4 years. She's got people lined up who have been asking her to be crew chief.
Wow.
She's going to be on the road forever.
Okay.
All right.
What else is new?
Well, our show started out tonight with two guests, then it grew to three, and now we have had this kind of uncanny luck, and we garnered an opportunity to talk with online bicycling editor Daniel McMahon about the start of the Tour de France. So there was a press conference with Team Radio Shack on Thursday, and not a lot of confidence exuded by the team. Manager Johan Brunil is stateside. He is struggling with the possibility of an indictment for doping rule violations from the ADA. Frank Schlecht wasn't his usual chipper self, which seemed to reflect the mood of the whole team right now. Daniel's plugged in and ready to talk with us about how he sees the race unfolding and what Bicycling Magazine's focus will be on the tour this year. Daniel's in Brooklyn, so we're just going to hang a left and stay in Brooklyn, where we're going to meet up with Will Doig, who's a journalist. Will has written for many great publications. He was the editor at the Daily Beast and currently writes the column Dream City for Salon.com. I have no idea of how and when I first came across Dream City, but I loved it from the first column I read and began to follow it online. It's about a lot of diverse things, about how and often about how bicycles fit into our lives. Will be with us in a few moments. So we're also going to spend a little bit of time with Jim Rutberg, who's the editorial director of Carmichael Training Systems in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Everybody's aware of the fires out there, and we've spoken with Jim in the past, but because of what's going on with the fires, I wanted to check in with Carmichael Training Systems and learn what's going on both in Colorado and what's going on at the training facility with the athletes who are not able to get outdoors and ride, run, and probably even swim right now. And then our last guest this evening is Ozzy Zenner. Ozzy is a visiting scholar at the University of Berkeley and the author of Green Illusions, The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy and the Future of Environmentalism. He primarily researches the social, political, and economic conditions influencing energy priorities and project outcomes. His work also incorporates symbolic roles that energy technologies play within political and environmental movements. His other research interests include consumerism, urban policy, environmental governance, international human rights, and forgeries. It's along the lines that he sees the bicycle as an important piece of the environmental puzzle that I think he'll fit well into our discussion this evening. So thanks for joining us. It's going to be a big show tonight. So sit back and let's check in with Bicycling Magazine's online editor, Daniel McMahon. Good evening, Daniel. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
You are going to be on your way to France shortly, I take it?
That's right. Actually, I head out on the 13th, so I'll arrive just in time for Bastille Day.
Ah. Well, as if there isn't enough controversy with the indictment of Lance Armstrong by the USADA, we also seem to have a bit of mayhem over in France ahead of the start of the tour. I read Joe's account of the press conference he attended on Thursday. What's going on over there?
Oh, certainly pretty interesting. Joe Lindsay wrote on his Boulder Report blog on bicycling.com that, you know, he was at the press conference and everyone, I think it was the most anticipated press conference probably of the whole, you know, pre-Tour de France press day. Radio Shack, Nissan, you know, the teams had a super difficult year and Joe described it in his post as, you know, being very tense. Essentially, the team has had all sorts of trouble. Maybe most notably, Andy Schleck had his crash at the Dauphiné a few weeks back, and that put him out of the race with some broken bones, and it also meant he wasn't going to start the tour, so they lost their big GC guy. So now brother Frank is stepping in, hopefully, but with over 100 kilometers of time trialing in this year's course, it's certainly going to be difficult for him to do well, I think, overall and make the podium, but you know, we'll have to wait and see how that goes. In other news, with the USADA charges against Lance Armstrong that you mentioned, we have another fallout from that, and that is that Johan Bernal won't be at the tour this year. He's their team manager, and you know he's won a number of tours with his riders, Contador and Armstrong. So having him not there, I think we'll have to wait and see what the effects of that are. But it's certainly going to be a challenge, and I think it was a last minute development. So I think the team's under some pressure, and maybe that was conveyed intentionally or not at the press conference today with people asking about the Johan pulling out last minute Andy Schleck not being there. And what are they going to do? What are they going to do in the race? Well, I think they said the right things and they spun it pretty well, as it were, and said, you know, we're going to have an open race. We don't have to control the race. We'll let Sky and BMC and some other big teams do that. And maybe we'll look for stage wins. We'll see what we can do. We'll see what we can do in the mountains. They certainly still have a very strong team, of course, and very capable riders and climbers. So could they do the overall? I mean, anything can happen on the tour, as we all know, but it looks like they're going to have to really switch up their plan and their strategy and kind of take it day by day.
Well, you know, reading the press conference report, there were other things going on at the same time, too. So evidently, it's not just about Brunel and about Schleck. It seems like everybody was a little disgruntled and didn't have the, you know, the excitement that you usually hear before the tour. It seems like maybe there's a little bit of, I don't know if worry's the word, or just sort of not a lot of impetus to race hard. I don't know. It sort of sounded sad to me.
I'd agree with that. I think that that's pretty well described. I mean, you just had a number of things that have happened recently. I mean, some of it rumors, some of it kind of silly news, if you will. I mean, there was the kind of flame up on Twitter between, you know, Andreas Klöden and Chris Horner, who I think, if you know, your listeners follow cycling pretty closely, probably heard about. And, you know, basically Klöden was saying, you know, to Chris Horner indirectly, without naming him, I think, saying, hey, you know, if you haven't been racing, you shouldn't be on the team. Of course, we know that Chris was originally not on the 14-man long list for the tour from Radio Shack, and that surprised a lot of people. And, you know, Klöden said, hey, you know, you really shouldn't be on the team if you haven't been racing. You got to earn that spot. And Chris kind of played that. I think he played it pretty well by saying, you know, I'm a professional and I know how to be ready for the tour, essentially. And I've done top 10 before and I know how to be ready. Last year, I didn't race in June, and got to the tour in great form. Of course, we know he ended up having that really horrific crash on stage 7, I believe it was. And that was the end of his tour. But, you know, there was that. And then there's also this, the Fuglsang, tour snub. Some are seeing it. He was supposed to be their GC guy at the Giro. He ended up pulling out of that race, and then he was going to be, or not even starting rather, because of illness. And then he was not invited to the tour, and there's all kinds of stuff going on with the team. It's really in, you know, turmoil, I think, is the operative word here. And I think the guys who are there are probably feeling that too. How can they not?
Yeah, sure. So what are you going to be doing over there? I mean, you are the online editor for Bicycling, and so Bicycling is pretty involved. What will you actually be doing in France for the duration?
Well, I'll be working a lot, that's for sure. And we're not working away, you know, try to at least savor a little bit of, you know, the great country that France is and the great race that the tour is.
Yeah.
We have a lot lined up for the tour this year. Simply, we have increased the number of guys that we're putting on the at-race crew, and we have Frank Andreu again with us. Last year, he was at the tour for about a week, and this year we have him for the whole race, so that was
cool.
Fantastic for us. We just really, you know, love Frankie's commentary and his sense of humor and his personality. It's so great to have that. So he and James Start, our European correspondent, they will be doing the Tour Talk series again, which we thought last year a lot of people enjoyed, and we're just thrilled to have them doing that for the entirety of the race this year. We got a lot going on. We also have Samuel Apt, of course. Again, people who follow cycling probably know the name, and
yep.
He's pretty much retired now. He's around 80 years old, lives in a suburb of Paris, but of course he covered over 30 tours, and he has a lot to say, and he certainly has opinions, and that's fantastic. So he's going to be contributing some stories to bicycling.com. For us. So that just brings a really interesting, in my mind anyway, a very interesting historical perspective, you know, 3 decades of the tour, and he has seen so much. So we're really looking forward to that. We have so much going on. We have some really cool stuff we're doing with video. We have kind of a beefed up video crew. So we're really focusing on our analysis of the race. We're going to be covering the play-by-play to some extent, but we're really focused more on getting deep into the tour and looking at team strategy and analyzing how the race is going and how it's evolving and just what's around the race as well. And to that end, we have a really cool iPad app right now that has a collection of James Thart's photography over the years.
Nice.
There's really a lot going on, so we're pretty excited.
Well, we will all be watching. There is live television coverage this year, too, so we're going to be able to out about the tour a lot. Are you going to head on to the Olympics after the tour? Are you going to head back over to London?
I don't think we're going to be able to head over to London.
Okay.
You never know what happens between now and then,
right.
But of course, we have the USA Pro Cycling Challenge, which is giving the Tour of California a run for its money, so we're going to be out at the USA Pro Cycling Challenge again this year and continue, our race coverage and just try to, give our readers the best coverage we can give them.
Well, I'm hoping that at some point during the tour, one of you guys will give us a few more minutes on air and have a great trip over to France. Thanks for taking time this evening and talking to us about bicycling and you and being involved in the tour and what's happening with the teams.
Thanks so much.
All right, Daniel. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Daniel McMahon joined us from Brooklyn, New York, where he is the editor of Bicycling Magazine Online, bicycling.com.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tour de France. Yes, indeed. It's time. I don't have good vibes from what I read.
Ready or not, here the tour comes.
Yeah. If you have a chance, you might want to go online and read Joe Lindsay's report of the press conference he attended last Thursday. It's interesting. Bicycling.com. Yeah.
Let's move along.
Okay.
And where do we go next?
We're only going around the corner.
Okay.
We're staying in Brooklyn,
New York.
Staying
in Brooklyn.
Yeah, we're going to be speaking with journalist Will Doig. Will is, he writes a column called Dream City for Salon.com. I fell in love with this column. So let's welcome Will to the show. Will, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. A lot of people in the bicycle world may not know of you, but I'm pretty certain that most of our listeners know about Salon.com. And I came across your column, Dream City, and saw an opportunity to speak with someone who sees transportation, urban, and bicycle issues from a different perspective than those of us who are in the industry. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got into journalism, and especially how you became interested in transportation and urban issues?
Sure. Well, I grew up actually not in an urban environment at all, mostly in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And but I lived in New York for 10 years, and I lived in Washington, D.C. before that. And I've been a journalist for pretty much ever since college, but I have only been writing about urban issues and transportation for about 8 months for Salon. And obviously in this day and age, so much of urban transportation involves bicycling, and so I've just kind of naturally become pretty familiar with those issues as well, in addition to just being a bicyclist myself.
So you live in New York City, well, Brooklyn. I'm assuming you use both public transportation and ride a bike?
I use everything.
Okay.
I use a bike, I use the subway, I use the buses, and I also own a car.
So you've seen a lot of changes in New York City in the past few years. Can you tell us a little bit about the good and bad and ugly of New York?
Sure. I mean, when I got here about 10 years ago, there was, basically no bicycle infrastructure at the time, or very little, and just not a lot of bicyclists. I think that a lot of people assumed it was dangerous, or sort of like me, I think that when you don't see the bicycle infrastructure, it literally doesn't occur to you that that's a viable way to get around. And I know that seems weird, but there was a time when I moved here that it would have never occurred to me to buy a bike and get around on a bike. And then when the bike lanes started going in, when our great transportation commissioner came in, Jeanette Sadi-Khan,
right.
That's when me and a lot of other people sort of started to think of bicycling as a viable form of transportation. And so that has really defined biking in the last 10 years in this city. Just a huge boom in bicycling, of people of all kinds. It's not just sort of the people in the, you know, in the spandex and the racing helmets, just, you know, really a kind of a new mode of transportation in a city that has so many. And so I think that not only has it been great for bicyclists, but I just think it's been great for the city in general as far as giving us another option in a city where a lot of the transit systems are kind of, you know, maxed out in general.
So you see it sort of as a chicken or egg thing. If we have the infrastructure, people will ride. And if people ride, we'll get some infrastructure. It's kind of an interesting dichotomy in a way.
Yeah, I think it builds on itself. I mean, when, you know, obviously there's bicycling is happening in cities all across the country. And I think a big reason for that is because a lot of the people who started moving to cities in the last 10, 15 years are people who are into the idea of biking anyway. So I think that you're right. It is a chicken and egg thing. And in that sense, they are the egg, but then in another sense, the bike lanes themselves are the egg because they, I think that they plant the idea in the minds of people who wouldn't otherwise have, who have started bicycling or who weren't into it in the first place. And so, you know, in a weird way, I think the bike lanes and the bike share systems and all these things kind of almost act as advertisements for bicycling, and they're striped right there on the street, and you can see them wherever you go, and you see other people using them, and so you think, oh, you know, maybe that's for me too.
It makes perfect sense to me. So let's talk about your column, Dream City. It's such a cool column. I love every time I see a new column come up. And two of my recent favorites are the When the 1% Say No and Bicyclists, the New Limousine Liberals. Let's talk a little bit about When the 1% Say No. Explain what you mean by that term and what it means for those who might want to ride, as well as just ordinary folks who might want to just hang their laundry out to dry.
Sure. So that column was basically about the issue of NIMBYism, the not in my backyard issue, which is, you know, obviously a problem in cities all over the place. It's basically when people, a small vocal minority opposes a project that would be beneficial for the city at large or even their neighborhood at large. The headline I'm not in love with because I don't think it is just a 1% problem. NIMBYs can certainly be people who aren't rich, and often they are people who aren't rich. But, as far as it involves, or affects bicycling, you know, it's been a problem here in New York in certain ways. We've had people in historic districts try to prevent bike share stations go into their into their neighborhoods because they feel like they disrupt the character of historic districts. Although, as one of the reporters on streetsblog.org pointed out, there are cars parked along every curb, which isn't exactly a historic device in and of itself. And so NIMBYism can affect bicycling that way. And then also just with bike lanes, we've had problems, and I know other cities have as well, with particular neighborhoods that just did not want bicycle lanes going through them. Here, in one case, it was a very wealthy street that they didn't want their boulevard kind of striped for the bike lane. Another issue here has been, and this is a few years ago, but it was a Hasidic community in Brooklyn that really didn't want bike lanes in their community because they don't want, basically they didn't want, you know, women who were, you know, in sleeveless shirts or skirts or anything like that riding through. So it can kind of manifest itself in strange ways.
We are speaking with Will Doig in Brooklyn, New York, about his column Dream City for Salon.com, and he talks about bicycling in a lot of different ways, including your piece, Bicyclists, the New Limousine Liberals. You want to talk to us a little bit about that piece? I thought that was interesting, too, about the bike. It started out about the bike share program in D.C.
Yeah, I mean, the headline, first of all, is certainly meant to be ironic. I don't think bicyclists are limousine liberals.
I know.
That article was responding to a video that was made by Reason Magazine, which is a libertarian magazine, and they basically made a reported video talking about why DC's bike share system, Capital Bike Share, is a bad use of public subsidy. And the reason that they gave was because a study came out showing that the bike share system in DC is used predominantly by white people, by people who are well-educated, and by people, they said people with money, although really it was just people who make the average income in D.C. It was not rich people. So the piece that I wrote was sort of in response to that, which was talking, you know, there are a lot of problems with the argument that they were making. I think that chief among them was the idea in their heads that bike share is not public transportation, and this is this kind of, you know, I think a misperception that a lot of people have that, you know, bike share is just about kind of riding around and having fun and, you know, people just sort of doing figure eights on their bikes, when really when the same study that they were quoting had actually showed that most people were using the bikes for things like doing errands or getting to, you know, personal appointments or getting to work. And I've used DC's bike share system many times when I go down there to visit, and I use it to get around. I actually use the subway system there a lot less frequently because it's a, you know, you can get around, the bike share system is so comprehensive. So, yeah, that was my point. The point was that I think that that report was kind of portraying bicyclists as these, you know, kind of be limousine liberals who don't really need this and they don't need a public subsidy. But what they weren't talking about was the fact that all public transportation gets a public subsidy, and rightly so, and bike share is public transportation.
The small amount of money that's been previously allocated for pedestrian and bicycle programs is about to be put on the chopping block, although today something else happened. What do you see as the reasons why bicycling is being so targeted? Well, it's not just bicycling, it's pedestrian, being so targeted as being, I mean, such a tiny amount of money. What do you think the big problem is?
I think the reason is the same reason that money for things like NPR gets targeted, and it's because it's not about the money. I mean, the Tea Party and all these fiscal conservatives, I think, do a really good job at, pretending that their arguments for saving money, which sounds so responsible and thrifty, and of course we should go along with that, I don't think that they're actually about saving money a lot of the time. I think that it's a way of arguing against things that you just don't like. And so when you talk about funding for something like bike, you know, infrastructure or NPR for that matter, that's such a tiny amount of money in the larger federal budget. It's basically a rounding error that cutting it wouldn't solve anything. And so basically, by using the argument that we need to save money, what they're doing is choking off funds for things that they just don't like. And the reasons that they don't like them have, you know, there's all sorts of reasons for it. They see it as same things that we were just talking about, a kind of like something for liberals or something that's silly or something that they just don't like for cultural purposes. I was following the news on this today, and I don't know, I wasn't sure how severe the cuts are going to be. It seems like it might still sort of be in flux, but obviously in this kind of environment that we're living in, it's really hard to get money for anything, even stuff that's a pretty worthy cause like bike infrastructure.
Yeah, I know that there a tiny little sliver has been sort of left there, but you know, it's pretty much on the chopping block. So
yeah.
What would you like to see going forward for urban planning in terms of transportation? It seems to be an area in which you are interested in, very well plugged in.
I mean, I could not. The thing that I would advocate for more than anything else is against cuts in funding for mass transit, which is exactly what's been happening in so many mass transit systems, including bike shares and bike infrastructure across the country. There's been reports from so many different cities where they're just cutting massive amounts of money from different public transportation systems, and this is happening at the exact same time that ridership on these systems is soaring. It's soaring because there's more people moving back to cities and because there's neighborhoods where people are living that they didn't, you know, used to want to get to, and now they're taking the train there. But I guess the point is, I think that there's a really deep disconnect between what's going on in Washington and what's going on in these cities. People are really, really into public transportation right now for the first time in a really long time. I mean, it used to be kind of, oh, you know, the bus is for poor people, or it's dirty, or the subway is dangerous, or I don't want to take that for whatever reason. And there's been a really, I think, strong cultural shift where people are into these modes of transportation now, and they don't necessarily want to own a car. At the exact same time that that's happening, Washington and these different cities are cutting funding for the very services that people want more of. So I would say, if I could wish for one thing, it would be for government and for public funding to get more in step with what people are asking for more of, rather than taking away funding from the one thing that they are actually demanding more of. And look, our cities are just getting denser and denser. There's no way that we can get around in cars. I mean, the more people that move to cities, and there was just a report that came out from the census today that talked about how cities are growing faster than suburbs for the first time in a really long time. The denser these cities get, there's no way that they can function without public transportation. And it's really upsetting when you see service cuts being put into place when that is really the smartest, most efficient way of getting people around.
Well, I can't believe our time is up already, but I really enjoyed talking with you, and I can't wait to read your columns some more. It's Dream City on Salon.com, and I'm going to be back at you when something else jumps up at me and says, ooh, I need to ask Will about that. So thanks for being on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
And hopefully we'll talk again not too distant future.
That would be great.
All right. Thanks, Will. Have a good night.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Will Doig joined us from Brooklyn, New York, where he writes for Salon.com.
He does indeed. He used to be the editor at the Daily Beast. He's written a ton of stuff. If you want a really interesting column, it's not written every single week or every single day, but every once in a while it pops up, and it's just awesome. Just the headlines will get you, and then you'll be sucked in. So I highly recommend it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, we got to stop jabbering here and take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we are going to talk to a couple more interesting folks on The Outspoken Cyclist. Don't go away.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Friday, August 3rd, the East Lake Police Department Benevolent Association will hold its 22nd annual golf outing and raffle. Funds raised through this event will support both EPBA initiatives and community causes, such as youth sports, school programs, and memorials. EPBA is currently accepting raffle donations and sponsors for this special fundraising event. Those interested in participating or registering to attend can learn more by calling EPBA at 440-951-1400.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Yes,
and,
we are.
Where are we going next, Diane?
We are going to Colorado Springs, which we're going to the part that is not burning at this moment.
Okay.
We're going to go speak with Jim Rutberg, who is the editorial director for Carmichael Training Systems, and he's going to tell us what CTS is doing to help athletes out in Colorado Springs. Good evening, Jim. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
It's nice to be with you again.
First off, how are you and your family faring? Everybody okay?
Yes, actually, my family is doing well, and actually the rest of our staff, as far as we know, none of our staff have lost homes in the fires. They confirmed today that 346 homes were destroyed, which makes it the most destructive fire in Colorado history. But we've had some folks who were evacuated, but nobody who lost their homes.
Well, yeah, I know Patrick O'Grady's out there. A bunch of people I know are out there. I just hope you guys all are safe. That's the most important thing. I wanted to touch base with you and Carmichael Training Systems again because of the turmoil from the fires in Colorado and something I saw from Chris on Facebook. So Chris was saying something about if athletes wanted to train, he was opening the Carmichael Training Systems to them. Tell us what it is you are doing, and it seems like a very gracious gesture.
Well, we have a facility here that has, it's both our corporate headquarters as well as a training facility. So we have 24 compu trainers downstairs. We have some strength training equipment. We have a few treadmills, and we're not going up against 24-hour fitness or something like that, but we have what endurance athletes use to train. We use them a lot during the winter. We use them a little bit less in the summer, but we have a steady membership that comes in and uses our facility for indoor training. And as we saw the air quality deteriorate in Colorado Springs, and the heat was, the temperatures were 95 degrees and above, the combination made it very difficult for anyone to ride outdoors. And obviously there were bigger issues that people were dealing with. It wasn't a major contribution to the aid going on in Colorado Springs, but it's what we had, and it's what we could do. We couldn't do much more to aid the people who were out of their homes and things, but it was one thing that we could do. So we opened up the facility so people could, instead of trying to train outdoors or in their own houses, miss training altogether, they can come in and use our facility where we have air conditioning and we, have lower temperatures and cleaner air.
That's great. I just think it's awesome. I thought it was such a nice gesture. Do you have suggestions for those who want to continue training who might be listening from anywhere in this kind of weather? What do you tell these athletes right now?
Well, the one big thing is that people can acclimate to pretty high temperatures. We have athletes who run the Badwater 135 through Death Valley. I mean, you can acclimate to pretty extreme temperatures. And usually as temperatures rise in the area where you are training, your body gradually acclimates to those temperatures. So if you were training when it was 80 and you were still training when it was 85 and still training when it got to be 90 as the spring warmed up, you become acclimated to it as the temperatures gradually change. Above, 90, 95 degrees and things, yes, it's going to be miserable regardless of how acclimated you are. And that's when your habits really come into play, whether it's starting early in the morning and riding before it gets very hot. I mean, we have a training facility in Tucson, Arizona, and everything that happens there happens very early in the morning in the summertime because you can't ride safely, really, in the afternoons there. So starting early in the morning, wearing lighter clothing, pre-cooling, not pre-cooling, but, pre-wetting of apparel sometimes can be helpful, things along the lines, you have ice socks and pouring water over your head, over your jersey. Those things are effective for getting heat to be carried away from your body in extreme temperatures and staying hydrated. I mean, it's just you're sweating that much more. And I remember the Ohio area and I remember the humidity and that, you just lose a tremendous amount of fluid.
Well, those are all really good ideas and tips, and I appreciate it. Well, I don't want to keep you. I know you guys have plenty to do out there, and I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us and telling us what's going on in Colorado. I know everybody's concerned. Everybody's watching the news, and it looks awful. I just hope everybody is safe. So,
well, the biggest thing that we've come away with, I believe, really is that 346 homes are destroyed and 32,000 people were evacuated. The acreage of the fire is something like 18,000 acres have burned, and yet there are no reported injuries and no fatalities. So,
that is pretty amazing when you think about it. I hope it stays like that. That's awesome.
Especially when you saw the neighborhoods evacuating on Tuesday when the fire was coming down the mountain, it was, people were watching their houses burn in the rearview mirror. So it was close.
It must be one horrific feeling, to look in the rearview mirror and know you're not going back to your house anytime soon. Wow. Well, thanks for joining me. I hope you have a good rest of your summer and probably see you at Interbike if you're going to be there.
I think we will have some folks there, so hopefully we'll see you at that event.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Have a great night.
You too. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Jim Rutberg from Carmichael Training Systems joined us from Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Right.
And nice to see that they're offering their facilities for athletes who aren't able to train outside right now.
Yeah.
That is a horrific situation.
It is horrific. And the pictures are just, they just blow you away.
Well, when nature gets going, whether it's a fire
right.
or a flood or a hurricane, the best thing you can do is just
get out of the way.
And fast as you can.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, we wish them all the best in the state of Colorado. And, we are so fortunate here in Northeast Ohio that we really don't have a lot of extreme weather events. The hills protect us mostly from the tornadoes. We don't have a lot of major flooding.
Nope. We don't get horrific amounts of snow where there'd be an avalanche, and
don't have enough elevation to have an avalanche, really.
And boy, that's so true.
Yeah. So we must.
We're very lucky.
We must thank our lucky stars that we live in such a in a protected area for the most
part.
And
we have plenty of fresh water.
Lots of fresh water and places to ride our bikes.
Exactly. Exactly.
I saw a posting this week that said, they say money can't buy happiness, but it can buy bikes and beer. Do we need anything else?
I always used to hear, money can't buy happiness, but it's way ahead of whatever's in second place.
That too. Yeah. Hey, the Cleveland Velodrome is almost done.
Yeah. There was a really good video of somebody actually riding it the other day. Gretchen Wiesenberg-Burkhardt took the video, and I'm going, yeah, look at that. And they're going, go, 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 go. It was so cool. I love that sound.
You know
Wheels
they,
on wood.
Yeah. You know what they have to do after now that the track is almost complete?
Now what?
They got to build the tunnel so you can get in the darn thing.
Well, that is, Brian was asking me about the in and out and how the skirts are going to work and all that. Yeah, I'm sure they have it figured out.
The artist's design shows a very nice tunnel that goes underneath and comes up into the infield, but that part's not built. They basically just started building that track right on the
ground.
The asphalt.
Yep.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
So, time for
one more guest.
One more guest this week.
We do, and I think this is one of the most interesting men out there today. He is a visiting scholar at Berkeley. And he wrote an article, actually, that was titled, Congress Raises a Middle Finger to Young Bicyclists, which is what sort of caught my attention. But then I found out that his most recent work is a book called Green Illusions, The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy and the Future of Environmentalism, or Sustainable Future. He's a fascinating guy. I can't wait to talk to him. So let's welcome him to the show. Ozzie, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you very much, Diane.
It's timely and relevant that you're on the show at this time. Congress did some weird things this week with the funding for bicycle and pedestrian programs, and you have some outstanding things to say about it. In fact, you said if stores and organizations wish to minimize their environmental footprint, then they can give priority access to bicyclers and pedestrians. Congress can do the same. They don't seem ready to do that. What's going on?
Well, yeah, this is an intriguing thing that's emerging right now. And we're in the midst of a major shift in transportation, and both globally and in the United States. And Congress seems to be completely unaware that this shift is occurring. In the 1980s, for instance, 45% of teenagers got a driver's license within a year of turning 16. But today that number has dropped to around 30%. And it's going lower, and that's because teens have become more comfortable with other options of connecting with friends. They connect through online networks and gaming. Even carpooling is growing among teenagers. So younger people are more interested in moving to cities where they can walk and bike. But unfortunately, Congress is stuck taking orders from industries that are invested in the past, industries that want to expand highway and road construction without much consideration, unfortunately, for the kind of walkable and bikeable infrastructure that we will need in the future.
Do you have any idea of how it's going to sort of meet up, that what's really necessary is going to finally overcome what they're being sort of under the table paid not to do?
It's difficult to know how much advancement we'll be able to make, because there's a lot of money flowing. It's kind of like swimming upstream in a river, a river with money flowing in the opposite direction. And there's a lot of industry money, for not just from road builders, but also other industries that are interested in trucking and transportation. So they're really well vested in the system. They have a lot of lobbyists in D.C., and they've been there for a long time, so their connections are well established. So it was going to be difficult to break through that, but I'm hopeful that over the coming years we will be able to look at interventions that we could take on a small level that might have the potential to grow larger as we move on.
Well, what first brought my attention to you and your work was the article, Congress Raises a Middle Finger to Young Bicyclists. And we talk a lot about the Safe Routes to School program on the show. It's important to keep that program alive, don't you think?
I do think that it's vital to keep that program alive, because that's really one of the best programs that we have currently. And for those people that haven't heard of it yet, it's a federal program called Safe Routes to School, and it it makes walking and biking to school safer and more practical for students and educators. It creates basically a buffer zone around schools, and it's been incredibly successful. But despite that success, Congress has whittled down its funding in the new transportation bill, which is currently going through Congress. And unfortunately, they've done that not to save money, which you might expect, but actually to redirect those safe street funds toward more car-centric infrastructure, or opening up the funding to local governments that can use it in a way that they can use for funding road and highway construction.
It's such a tiny amount of money. It's not like it's huge. I mean, they can't even build, you know, a bridge with the amount of money that was set aside for SRTS. It seems so insane to me that we can't seem to get people to actually understand why it's so important. So how do you see the bicycle fitting into environmental solutions?
Well, to start, if you want to reduce foreign dependence on oil, then supporting walkable and bikeable communities is really the place to start. And there's no secret to this. There's no secret to designing safe and convenient bikeable and walkable communities. And the strategies are flexible to a wide array of neighborhood layouts. They're simple to institute. Bike lanes return a rapid payback in terms of public safety, quality of life, energy footprints, and also in long-term infrastructure and maintenance costs. And all of those have environmental impacts as well.
Well, and environmentalism is what we're going to talk about, your book right now. So your book is Green Illusions, The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy and the Future of Environmentalism, Our Sustainable Future. And it details a lot of the myths about what we think are environmentally sound solutions. So what are truly green things, and what are things that people think that are green, good, environmentally sound solutions that really aren't?
Oh, that's really the question that I ask in Green Illusions. And so
Right. Essentially,
Green Illusions is an invitation. It says, hey, come over here and look behind the curtain, because there's some things going on that you'd probably like to know about. I write about the disadvantages of technologies like solar cells and electric cars and compare them to better solutions such as walkable and bikeable neighborhood design that we've just been talking about. And I make the argument that environmentalists should take a more critical look at the type of energy production technologies that they're supporting and consider dropping technological distractions, as I kind of label them, and instead concentrate on initiatives that hold a greater potential, things that we might not consider to be environmental work historically, but are actually intimately intertwined with environmental thought. And those are things like human rights, material consumption, governance, and walkable communities.
Yeah, it's fascinating work. I just think it's so interesting that that people, you know, look at, well, I recycle, therefore I am green, and that may not be the whole story. In fact, it only touches on a little portion of that. So what do you see as the green things that will, in fact, make a difference besides, say, walkable and bikeable communities? What other kinds of things, and are there things people can do in their own lives to be more environmentally correct, or, you know, at least give us a future?
Well, you've hit on the big question of our time, I think.
And oh, okay.
I think that the green initiatives that will be the most successful are those that speak to people's interests. And, for instance, you know, researchers have done several studies on neighborhood preferences. And on one side of the table, they lay out pictures of walkable communities. And then on the other side of the table, they lay out pictures of typical suburban sprawl. And then they ask the participants, where would you rather live? Would you rather live in this suburban sprawl area with the strip malls and the roads that look vacant with parking lots, or would you rather be in this more dense, walkable, unbikeable neighborhood? And overwhelmingly, people point to the walkable neighborhood, and that's because for most people, these neighborhoods are a lot more sane and a lot more enjoyable, and they often tend to be more green as well.
Well, you know, one of the things that you actually wrote, we've built neighborhoods deep in forests that are bound to catch on fire. It seemed to be more than a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I can claim any. I don't know if I can claim anything for this, but the fires that are going on this summer speak to the kinds of risks that we build up through various pursuits of growth and production. And suburbanization is one of those pursuits. And another one is energy, which is the main focus of Green Illusions. And we have an inclination to solve our energy production problems by generating more energy. And that's because we generally associate more energy with increased prosperity. And we've found that that holds in poor regions of the world, but among industrialized nations, the correlation is roughly flipped. And that's because reckless energy consumption instigates a host of negative side effects and liabilities. And so as the challenges to wrestle energy from the earth intensify over coming years with increased price volatility, so will the burdens. And unfortunately, those burdens will probably be felt most strongly among people in the developing world and the poor residents of the industrialized world.
So do you see a prognosis for the future that has any positive effect? I mean, is there going to be a future for future generations?
Yeah, definitely there will be. I do see a greater volatility in energy prices coming, and that will really affect the way that we live. And so regions that have, or cities or regions that have diversified their transportation models to prioritize things like walking and biking will experience, for instance, a smoother transition through that volatility. And the fact that national energy use is high is actually causing a lot of grief. As I mentioned, in poor communities, which are often disproportionately affected by the side effects of energy use. And so slowing the expansion of things like suburbanization and road construction, and even energy production, we can actually improve standards of living. And in fact, that has occurred in other countries, and so we know that it's possible. And so I feel that our success, environmentally speaking, will depend on our ability to speak to people's desires. And overall, I hope that that will be more enjoyable than we might think. And I outline actually about 36 steps in Green Illusions that try to push us in that direction or create some ideas to spur thought.
So would you let our listeners know where to get a copy of Green Illusions? It just sounds like a book anybody who's interested, not just in bicycling, but in the environment and in the way they live their lives, would be interested in reading.
Sure. Well, Green Illusions is being published actually internationally by the University of Nebraska Press. And they can get it at any bookstore or library. I always encourage people to look for it at the library. And if they want a free chapter, they can go online at greenillusions.org and they can get a free chapter there.
So what's next for you? This is a wonderful book, but I know you're a visiting scholar out in Berkeley. How long will you be there?
Well, I don't know how long I'll be at Berkeley currently, but I don't have any plans of leaving this area anytime soon. I actually work between Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and the Berkeley area. And I'll probably continue speaking at universities and to people about these issues for the foreseeable future.
Well, have you ever considered coming down to the Bike Summit? Have you been there in D.C. for the Bicycle Summit?
Oh, no, I have not. I always miss it.
Oh.
And I would really like to.
Well, let me be the first for 2013 to invite you. Come to the Bike Summit. I'd love to meet you in person. You can sign my book.
Thank you very much.
Well, all right.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I'd love to, Diane.
And I will keep looking at what you're doing, because it certainly holds an interest for me. And I think it holds an interest for a lot of our listeners. It's not just about biking. It's about the way we live our lives.
It truly is. Thank you very much for recognizing that and saying it so succinctly.
Thank you. And have a wonderful evening out in Berkeley.
Great. Thank you, Diane.
Okay. Bye-bye, Assie.
Bye.
Ozzie Zehner joined us from Berkeley, California.
Yes, he did.
Where he's taking a little time off from academics this summer and promoting his book.
Which just seems like a fascinating book. I am going to the library. I just took a library book back, so I'm going to get another one out. I'm going to order this one right away.
Oh, nice.
I like
nice.
The South Euclid Library.
You know, the paradigm is shifting.
It is shifting.
And I like his analogy that Congress just hasn't figured it out yet. You know,
I'm not sure that that's rocket science right there. Anybody
not.
Who's paying attention, except Congress, can't seem to get out of their own way.
But we ascribe to Congress this sort of relevance that they don't necessarily have.
That's a
but
good point.
But we assume that they are relevant because, hey, they're the government. They're
and
in charge.
And we elected them.
We elected them.
By
but,
the way.
But they're making the laws.
Right.
So, you know, why wouldn't they be, you know, current? But not necessarily.
No.
Yeah.
I would
Things
say not.
Things are changing.
Yes.
Gene and I were down in Ohio City last weekend, and right in front of ABC The Tavern on West 25th, the local people listening will know where this is. There was not room to park one more bicycle in front of that bar.
Yeah. How cool is that?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, we had a bunch of drunk cyclists out on the road. Who knows?
I don't know how much they were drinking, but right. I'm telling you, it's there are certain pockets even around here in,
yes.
In Cleveburg.
In Cleveburg.
Where that stuff's catching on.
Well, and what's interesting is what you say. The wrong people are not noticing, or the right people are not noticing. I don't know.
Yeah. It was interesting. I signed the LAB's online petition
yes.
to send comments about the transportation bill to my representatives.
And?
Well, I got one back from our Democratic senator, which was, as you would expect, you know, very supportive. Thank you. I'm voting for all the things that you hope I'm voting for.
Senator Brown.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown. Mm-hmm. I got one back from our Republican representative. And, you know, in the spirit of nonpartisanship of cycling and mass transit, very supportive, Representative La Tourette.
Right.
And then I got one back from our Republican senator from Ohio.
Mr. Portman.
Mr. Portman, the Honorable Rob Portman. And every other word in that email was roads and bridges, roads and bridges, roads and bridges.
Really?
It was. He couldn't even bring himself to talk about anything that wasn't
Couldn't say
about...
the B word, huh? Can't say the B word. Bicycle.
Can't say the B word, yeah.
That's
those,
too bad.
Those two-wheeled things that don't exist in my world. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, well. On that note.
All right, then. That's about enough show for this week, I think.
I think we outdid ourselves again.
It's over for another week. We'll be back next week. And so nothing more to see here. Go ride your bike.
And have a happy 4th of July.
Oh, yes.
Yes, indeed. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.